Welcome to another episode of the Scholars Podcast, Conversations with Inspiring Leaders. I'm your host, Justin Kelly, and today I'm delighted to say we're featuring Associate Professor Harrison Steele. Harrison has been named a rising star in the world of engineering for his work across NASA space projects and COVID-19 relief efforts. Currently an associate professor at the University of Oxford, Harrison's work focuses on robotic technologies combined with biological engineering. His goal is to design solutions to many of the 21st century's most pressing problems. After graduating from the University of Sydney, where Harrison received first-class honours in mechanical space engineering and advanced science, he went on to complete a PhD in engineering science as a John Monash Scholar at Oxford. He has invented robotic platforms that have been commercialized and distributed worldwide with dozens of academic and industrial laboratories now using his technologies. Harrison, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Justin. Very nice of you to have me today. I'm very glad to be talking with the Monash community and sharing a bit more about what we're up to here in the UK.
Well, you're joining us from the UK. You're a long way from home. You're now an associate professor, as I mentioned in my introduction. You are specializing in synthetic biology and robotics. So first off, for those who don't understand what that is, can you explain what it is you do and what your day job actually entails?
Yeah, sure. Maybe I'll start with the synthetic biology part. So in many respects, this might be similar to what people understand as GMOs, so genetic engineering. Of course, maybe the most common things we've heard of in that area would be things like crops, which are pesticide resistant, and indeed engineering crops to be pesticide resistant or require less fertilizer, therefore reducing their impact on the environment. These are very important research areas, which are still ongoing. But then synthetic biology goes beyond this, beyond crops or agriculture, to also think about how do we engineer bacteria to take waste products out of the environment and turn them into something useful, like bioplastics, for example. That's something that we're working on here. Or how do I engineer other kinds of cells, maybe different bacteria, maybe even cells similar to ones in a human to be new kinds of therapeutics, to bacteria that can live inside of the body and it can tell a doctor if something's wrong with somebody by changing color or otherwise being measurable. And so really the synthetic biology is all about how do we see what nature has done over billions of years of evolution. It's invented all kinds of amazing technologies far beyond what we could ever possibly build with traditional engineering at the nanometer scale, tiny scale. And so we're learning from what nature's done there and trying to repurpose it, all these different challenges. And then I suppose alongside that, the robotics is that, well, doing all this engineering of nature is ultimately really hard work. It's often people in labs for 12 hours a day trying to convince the bacteria to do what they want. Often these are difficult things to do because the bacteria live on their own schedule. It's not like a person or even like a puppy that you could tell, do this, do that. It's a single cell organism, so you can't really communicate with it. And so ultimately you're on their schedule, and that often means you might have to feed them at 3 a.m., which is no way to live your life, waking up at 3 a.m. every day to feed your bacteria. So a lot of our robotics is all about how do we automate that kind of stuff, take out the tedious tasks and make a robot which doesn't really mind help us out with our research. I hope that clarifies it a bit.
It does. So how then does your research, how do you integrate the robotics with the biology to address some of these challenges that we're facing today?
Our robotics are never quite as glamorous as the ones you might see in Star Wars or something, in that it's never like a walking man type robot. Ours are more like containers and liquids moving through tubes and microscopes moving samples back and forth with different cameras taking pictures, for example. So it's not the sci-fi version of robotics. It's more like what you might imagine in a factory with all these big complicated processes. And what they're doing, you know, we have experiments running at this very moment in our lab. There's cells growing, cells are being fed by a robot. While this is happening, we're measuring how many cells there are, we're measuring what chemicals they're producing. We can often see the chemicals based on the colors, for example, of the cell. And then we can run these kind of very complex experiments, which would otherwise be very, very, very intensive for a person to do. We can do them automatically, which saves us a lot of hassle. Although, of course, the robots break down, the robots go wrong too. It would be remiss to say this is like a magic fix to make all our science go easier. It fixes some problems, but it does create other problems for you.
Well, you've touched on how they can be used. Maybe can you go a little deeper into some of the practical applications of the robotics and the robotic platforms that you've developed?
I mean, we do a lot in our lab, but some of the even more exciting things have happened around the world with, for example, startup companies that have taken on some of these technologies. So maybe I can think of three examples. So one kind of broad family of examples are people using these bioreactors to develop things like artificial meats or artificial proteins. So thinking about how we can go beyond growing a cow in a field, which is great for the cow, but sometimes, you know, factory farming, not so good, also not so good for the environment. If we could maybe grow some of these, you know, food products in a bioreactor, it can be much more environmentally and maybe even financially sustainable in the world.
I've not tasted them. I know there are a few startup businesses that are developing that. Apparently it tastes okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few in Sydney in Australia that actually have used our technology in the very early stages. So our technology is often aiming to be, you know, small scale, really cheap stuff to help people just get started in a new area. And so many companies use it when they're in the first year or two before they graduate to, you know, these million-pound bioreactors. Ours are much more accessible and open source. And so we've worked with a lot of them. I mean, I've tried some of the artificial meat stuff before. It can be really good. Can be almost indistinguishable from the real thing, but at the moment there's still many challenges. It still costs maybe 100 times more than what you pay in the supermarket. So they've got big challenges ahead of them to try and bring that cost down so that people can afford it as a day-to-day replacement. So yeah, that's one example. Another example maybe is that people have used our technology, and we've also worked on, you know, how do we take pollution out the environment. So for example, carbon capture, growing cells which take CO2 out of the air and turn it into something useful or something we can dispose of. This is, again, something that is often engineered with bioreactors, that we would grow these cells, we try and optimize them, take as much CO2 out of the air as we can, and then maybe one day they get attached to a factory where now instead of going straight into the atmosphere, the factory's, you know, outflowing gas goes into a bioreactor, the cells take that gas, turn it into plastic maybe, and then that's a win for the environment, and we also get basically very cheap or free plastic out of it, which is a second benefit of turning a waste product into something that we actually want.
What about any actual breakthroughs, some notable milestones that you've achieved in your research thus far, Harrison?
I guess what motivates me is really building these technologies. And I mean, I don't know if we would claim that we are fundamental scientists who are necessarily looking for a specific truth, let's say. We do spend a lot of time studying biology and trying to understand better how biology works and how we can engineer biology. But many of our, I think the things we're most proud of are how we've used biology to solve some problems. So for example, working on convincing bacteria to make bioplastics and then having bioplastics which sense and respond to things, or taking some of the robots we developed for our own work and then making these into open source products which then get used by hundreds of others around the world. And then, you know, we get to know them. We build lots of collaborations. It's really nice to see people taking your technology and using it here in examples like I mentioned before, but also far beyond this, much more than you could really imagine yourself when you start out trying to develop these technologies. So it's always very exciting to see what gets taken up and where it goes once it kind of leaves your own lab and your own research team.
How do you work out if an idea is worth pursuing? Obviously, you would get pitched some crazy ideas and you just have thought bubbles any time of the day. What's your process, Harrison, in working out, okay, maybe we could attack it from this way if we did X, Y, Z? I'm keen to dig into that a little bit.
That's a good question, one that I don't really have I don't think anyone really has a perfect answer to. How do you pick the good ideas? If we could, then I mean, I suppose we'd all be billionaires and we'd make all the technologies of tomorrow because we'd be able to figure out which ones they are. At least for me, I suppose there's a few things that I think about. So you're right that people often come with ideas. For example, we have lots of people that join our research team to do projects, and often they have great ideas. And then we have a tricky job of narrowing down to pick a specific challenge. And so there's a few different things. I mean, on one hand, we want to pick something that we can imagine could be really important in 5 or 10 years. So, I mean, there's no point working on something that you think is never going to be useful. I mean, it may not be useful. And secondarily, you're probably not going to be that motivated. You want to pick something that you're motivated to solve, because so much of science and innovation is about, you know, really having a passion for it and driving it forwards. So that's one thing, thinking about the long term. And of course, we don't know the future. We can only take a guess, but of course, we can hopefully have an informed guess. And then there's a few other things I think about. So one other thing is, often we try and think about how a new idea would be adjacent or build upon things that we're already doing, and therefore give us a head start. I mean, I can't remember who said it, but there's some quote out there about how you should never play on a level playing field in life. You should only enter a competition when you think you've got an unfair advantage. And so this is what we try and do, where we think about ideas, and if there's one which is already using a technology that's unique in our lab, then that's a good idea, because there's no way anyone in the world could compete with us, because we already have this technology. Of course, if they spent, you know, years developing it, they could catch up. But, you know, the fact that we often have an uneven playing field in innovation technology, because, you know, our lab may have spent, you know, 3 years developing some unique system which no one else has, you should certainly use that as much as you can. But then the flip side of that, I guess, is a third thing I think about, which is, you know, we don't want to go into competitions with people who we think have a big advantage on us. And again, that's a tricky one to navigate, because, for example, you know, in the biopharmaceutical industry, there's these trillion-dollar companies with basically unlimited deep pockets. And so we try and have some awareness of what they're doing, and then not to go in and battle with them in a competition where it would be David versus Goliath if we don't think we have a unique edge, because otherwise, you know, probably Goliath wins, unless there is some special reason that David can get ahead. That's not to say that, you know, the big companies dominate or have all the good ideas. In fact, many times the small research teams do a lot more exciting stuff because they're more nimble and can take bigger risks. But it is important, I think, to be clear on where your strengths are and where your weaknesses are, and then based on this, try and decide what you should do, rather than just chasing after the same, you know, shining goal that everybody else has. Because if you join a big competition like that, you ultimately become a competitor, and that can be, well, there's both pros and cons to that.
The flow-on question to that, Harrison, is what are some of the key challenges, therefore, that you have encountered in your research, and how have you worked to overcome them?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think a big challenge for us in general is that we do a very interdisciplinary research program. So I suppose you could think about three core pillars of it. So the one is having biotechnology and synthetic biology, like we just talked about. Another pillar is the robotics that we just talked about. And then the third pillar is really like artificial intelligence, software engineering, control engineering, all of these mathematical and kind of software-based fields, which are really what you need to tie these things together. And so a big challenge for us on a day-to-day basis is trying to take the best of all those things and wrap them together to solve coherent problems, which is tough, because it requires people to have a good understanding of all of them. It's probably not possible to be the best in the world at all three. And so at least in our case, what we try and do is recruit a diverse team of people. So we have people from biology backgrounds, people that have studied entirely biology. Then we have people from software engineering or computer science or math. And then we have engineers or physicists who have done more of the robotics and hardware. And so hopefully by bringing together these different people with different expertise, we can solve some of these problems. Of course, you can imagine that, you know, big companies, imagine they also have this. They have people from all kinds of backgrounds. But often you'll find they get kind of siloed, in the sense that all the software engineers are doing one thing in a company and all the biologists are doing the other. And so I see one of our advantages in academic research is that we can have a single lab with about 15 people. They can all know every other person. They all know what every other person is good at. And so you can actually have this meaningful collaboration with people from very different areas, building on each other's strengths. And this is certainly something I'm excited about as an engineer to take advantage of.
And just to close the loop on this line of questioning, what then would be some of the current limitations or bottlenecks that you are facing in the field? And what areas do you think require further exploration?
Yeah, that's a very good one. It's something I think we think about a lot when we're trying to do this long-term planning, like this impact thing we talked about. So I think a big one in my mind at the moment, very, I suppose, topical, is that we're moving from this era of, I suppose, traditional biosciences into what might be described as AI-driven biosciences, so data-driven. And traditionally, and it's a bit of a sweeping statement, but still, traditionally, biology has often been done 3 experiments at a time. If you ever go in a biological lab, you hear them talk about triplicates, which is that you often do 3 conditions or, you know, three repeats. And so in your measurement, in your data, you have 3 data points, right? You have 3 measurements of something. But if there's a lesson we can learn from AI in the past 2 years or so, and it's the recent OpenAI era of LLMs and so on, it's that you can get huge gains in what you're doing just by putting in more information. Maybe not just by putting in, you need to be smart and you need to have good models, but we've seen time and again that, you know, people will have a smart idea, but then someone else comes with a way better system just by basically investing more money and data in it. And so for us in biology, a big transition is going from these triplicates, so 3 measurements, to at least in our lab, our goals are to get to the hundreds of thousands or millions. And so there's some areas in biology this has already happened. So things like protein folding, for example, there's been some massive advances in AI in the past 5 or 6 years. But we're trying to do this in other experimental areas where we're trying to go from just 3 to a million, which then means robots. There's no way a person can do a million experiments in parallel. It's going to have to be a robot. And so that's why we're doing all this robot development, to try and scale up in that way to get to the regime of data where you could actually use the really strong AI techniques that are being developed.
Let's change tack ever so slightly, and I'm keen to get your thoughts on the future of synthetic biology, Harrison, particularly in terms of its impact on industry and society. Where are things headed?
Oh, it's a good one. I mean, it's like I said, it covers so many different areas, and we can imagine so many different directions where it could succeed or it could not succeed. So, you know, some of the big wins from the past decades, things like in the 20th century, synthetic biology produced insulin, right, which was previously very difficult to produce as a medicine. And then a company in the US, Genentech, reprogramming bacteria to produce that. And since then, we've seen similar cases where synthetic biology has taken products like chemical and made it at scale. And so we've seen successes like this, but we haven't necessarily seen successes which are the kind of science fiction ideas we have at the moment, where we could have like a living bacteria that lives inside the human gut and makes measurements and tells you if the person has some disease or another. A big US Boston-based startup just closed down a few weeks ago working in this, which was really one of the trailblazers. And, you know, people had been excited about these guys for many years. And so many people are disappointed to see them close down, but it kind of is a moment of people coming back down to earth and saying, well, we can have all the good ideas we want in the world, but often there's something that works in the lab, that works in my research team, doesn't necessarily translate to clinical use or use in the environment. So this is going to be something that will be a challenge for us in synthetic biology going forwards in the next decades. How do we actually take the things which are working in a lab, which work with me or a PhD student or a postdoc doing it behind a bench, and how do we have it work out there in the wild where we actually want the solutions to happen?
And is it worth it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, some things, I mean, coming back to this artificial meat question, we'd love artificial meat if it was, and it will probably be better for the environment, but people are not going to pay 10 times as much for something which is a bit better for the environment. And so we really have to face these realities of economics and governance to actually get these technologies out there, and also regulation and public acceptance. And so this is something synthetic biology has done a lot of work in. There's a big focus on talking to the public, telling them what's going on, because we don't really want synthetic biology to go the same way as, let's say, I don't know, GMOs or nuclear power, where you have these nascent technologies which could make a huge impact on the world, but are held back by, you know, opposition, sometimes sensible, sometimes maybe not necessarily sensible or scientific, and it gets kind of cultish. in the belief that this thing is bad, whereas actually maybe all the evidence we have says, for example, nuclear power is very safe, is much lower emission than coal power, is much better for the environment, even than many renewable sources, and yet there's very few worlds in the countries in the world that have really lent into it. And so it's tricky, I think, to navigate these technologies, because they can get knocked back by not even just technical things. So it's the artificial meat. It's one thing for us to get it cheap enough for people to pay for it. It's something else for everybody to be happy to do that. I mean, I'm happy to do it because I'm a researcher in this, and I kind of trust the technology and have seen it with my own eyes and then used it with my own hands. But for some person on the street or my grandma or something to accept it is a difficult question.
And just going into that a little bit further, so there are obvious ethical considerations, potential risks associated with engineering biological systems with advancement. So how do you approach that? You've touched on it in your previous answer, but how do you navigate your way through all of that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There's different ways, I suppose. One way is, for example, in the medical space, we already have this big infrastructure of how drugs come to market, right? There's multiple rounds of clinical trials. You would test in some severe cases where, you know, if someone didn't get the drug, they could be very unwell, and so it's really necessary. And then you might do several clinical trials and eventually prove that it works or doesn't. And so in areas like that, you feel that there is a clear path. But in other areas, let's say some of these environmental cases where people are thinking about, for example, releasing mosquitoes into the wild, which are not able to spread malaria. That's already happening. So in California, there have been some trials that whether or not it's going to easily get out to the rest of the world is difficult to say.
Why are they releasing mosquitoes?
So what they're doing is, I mean, you know, mosquitoes carry malaria, which is a big problem for one of the biggest killers every year in the world. And so scientists figured out how they could do various adjustments to mosquitoes to prevent them from carrying malaria. So they could bite people, but they wouldn't carry malaria, which will be great, right? Because we don't necessarily want to get rid of mosquitoes, but we kind of do want to get rid of the malaria. And so this is already being tested in the wild as people releasing engineered mosquitoes to test, can we actually have them go out there and then kind of take over the other mosquitoes that would otherwise be living in the lakes?
Right. Breed out a malaria-carrying mosquitoes.
Exactly. It seems like a crazy science fiction thing, right? We engineer every mosquito in the world, but it might be possible. I mean, we think it is possible, and people working on this have worked on it for decades, and they've invested millions, billions probably in testing this in labs, doing test after test, saying, does it do what we expect, or does it do something unexpected? And finding that it does what we expect. We've tested this technology in so many ways. Finally, we get to the point of testing it in the wild, and so it's exciting to see what happens, and hopefully it saves millions of lives. But it's always difficult to make that step because, you know, if you and me sitting here on our couch, we're living a comfortable life, there's people out there that have malaria, and this is their day-to-day reality, and it's often us who are making the decisions about these things, people that are in, you know, well-resourced, developed Western nations. And we have to decide what happens and what we can invest in. But actually, the people that bear the brunt of our good or bad decisions, I mean, whether that's climate change disproportionately impacting people in the global south or many of these tropical diseases is very challenging. And so trying to balance, you know, what we think should happen versus what people really need out there is always difficult. And we need to engage them in those conversations as much as possible.
I mentioned in my introduction, Harrison, that You played a role in dealing with COVID-19. I'm keen to get your personal insights into what you actually did. Can you shine a light on the role you played, however big or small, in what you did when the world was hit with the coronavirus and stopped for 2 years and was shut down? What role did you play?
Sure. It was an exciting time in many respects for engineers and doctors and clinicians across the world. So I was here in Oxford at the time, having just got to the end of my PhD. And so, you know, the whole thing kicked off and an email went around from a colleague saying, you know, we all this, you know, look in the news, talk to clinicians, in the early days of the pandemic, the clinicians in both Italy and China were saying ventilators is what we need and what we don't have. You know, these devices which are used for people who are in very, very bad health to keep them breathing when they would otherwise not be able to breathe. And so I kind of joined this early on in, I suppose, March 2020 and came onto this team who were just trying to make as quickly as possible a new kind of ventilator for the UK, because the UK decided they needed tens of thousands of ventilators. They needed them in a hurry. There was no way they were going to be able to buy them because the entire world wanted ventilators. And even if the other rest of the world didn't, there's no way you can just buy 30,000 of these things immediately because they take ages to build and they're expensive. So at that time, we kind of sat down and made almost the simplest ventilator you could imagine in about 2 days, just with parts we had lying around. So a long way from a device you would attach to a person, just a demonstration of an idea. And then there was in the UK this thing called the Ventilator Challenge, which the government basically invested in a bunch of teams in order to build rapidly manufacturable ventilators to get out there as quickly as possible, you know, the goal being to make thousands within a few months so that the country will be ready for the peak of the pandemic, which was expected in mid-2020. And so, you know, we presented to the Cabinet Office. Our team was picked as one of the ones funded by the government for this and partnered with a medical device manufacturer. And then myself and about, I suppose, a dozen other engineers and clinicians from Oxford went and stayed basically at a hotel next to this factory of medical devices for about a month or so, basically taking our designs, iterating our designs, and making them into a product which could be manufactured really quickly and at a large scale. And so in this project, I was kind of responsible for doing all the electrical engineering and then device design, integrating everything together, making circuit boards, things like this, and then working with our team to develop the software that goes onto these circuit boards and working with other clinicians and experts in the medical field to build the rest of the system out to, you know, be a working ventilator. Of course, it was never going to be as good as, you know, a ventilator that costs £100,000, but the goal was this will be something that people could get real quick and thousands of if necessary, if they were needed. And so really, you know, myself and the others in this team worked very intensely on this for several months. You know, we made many prototypes, production line planned with this company that was really fantastic at doing this scale up. And then at some point during the pandemic, you know, the clinical data kept coming in, and eventually they basically realized that maybe ventilation was not the best treatment for most COVID patients. There was other treatments that were more effective in almost all cases. And so basically at some point, the government kind of revised their estimates. This is not them backtracking. This is sensible, right? This is how science works. You know, you make the best guess you can with the information you have. And then if you have more information later, you should change your mind. And so this is what happened. I mean, after more clinical tests in the UK, the government said, well, actually, probably 95% of these cases shouldn't use a ventilator. They should use something else or a different treatment. And so basically they shut down most of these projects, which was a bit disappointing at the time because, you know, we'd been working like 16 hours a day for a month living in a hotel in the middle of a pandemic. And they just kind of said, go home, we don't need you anymore, which, you know, was perfectly fine.
Game over.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's the right thing to do. They should stop investing in things which are not the best solution. But of course, it was dispiriting at the time for this team. It still went on to be quite successful in that you know, it's still actually going as an open source ventilator, working with other countries, places where there's not much access to the medical technologies needed, and trying to get these things out there to help as many people as possible. Because now that the time and effort has gone into developing them, why not have them help people? But of course, you know, it's not so easy as you just develop something in the pandemic, then you ship it out to help people afterwards. I mean, medical devices are, for good reason, heavily tested, regulated. It's not like you can just go and put this on a person. So ultimately, they did a bunch of testing with them, but then decided they weren't going to go out and use them on people because, like I said, they were not necessarily the best treatment for the condition. So in some ways, it was disappointing. In some ways, it was, I think, a relief. You know, we spent a lot of time working on this, and we knew and we were honest that this was not as good as a £100,000 ventilator. It didn't have all the bells and whistles because it's something that you had to make really quick. And so in many respects, it's quite a relief thinking, well, gosh, thank God that there's not going to be, you know, 1,000 grandmas across the country developing, relying on our technology to survive. It's quite a relief. You kind of feel a weight off your shoulders. But it was an exciting memory. It's a very different way to do engineering and research in the sense that, you know, during the pandemic, the government basically said, you can infringe any patent you want, just copy anything you want. Basically, we would just email companies and factories and just say, hey, could you help us with this thing? And they would just give us whatever we want for free. You could just get anything for free because it was part of this global and national effort to help the country. And most engineers would either be sitting at home not working because of the shutdown, or they could work on this. So, of course, everyone would, of course, jump onto this straight away. Another thing I kind of remember, which was exciting, was actually at some point we had to transport these circuit boards we designed across the country. So, you know, I'd been sitting there designing on my laptop, and then we emailed some company in the south of the country and said, you manufacture these and send them to us. They did it real quick. And then we couldn't get them because the roads were too slow and it was lockdown. There was no convenient lorry driver to drive them across. And so we asked this cabinet office consulting firm, please, could you organize this? And they organized the Queen's private helicopter. Somehow this was what was available. And so, you know, we went to an airfield near this factory, and what turned up was, you know, the Royal Helicopter with the Queen's logo on it. I mean, unfortunately, the Queen was not there. I guess she was in lockdown somewhere. But that was somehow what the government had available on that day to transport the circuit boards we designed. And it was only a tiny box, you know, like 30 centimeters on a side of circuit boards.
Hey, if you're going to do it in style, right?
Exactly. We needed them quick to test the next generation of the devices, and so we got them real quick. So it was exciting.
And am I right in saying that Oxford played a significant role in developing the first vaccine?
Yeah, Oxford, I mean, I was only involved in some of these projects. I mean, I was not at all involved in the vaccine in any way. But yeah, this was a big flagship for the university. So they had an institute already working on vaccines for similar conditions called the Jenner Institute. And so the team there was real prepared. They had all the kind of technology and expertise necessary. And so they developed what became the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, which I think, I'm just from memory, but I think it was the vaccine which saved the most lives in the world. It was not actually the one that necessarily had the most protection, but it was one that didn't require very difficult logistics to ship out. So it didn't require, you know, this cold chain to the same extent as the mRNA vaccines. And so this meant it could be shipped much more easily across the world to many people that needed it. And so it was a real boon in that respect. And then, you know, beyond this vaccine, Oxford did a huge amount of modeling of the pandemic. They did and led some of the biggest drug trials in the UK, so different drugs to treat COVID. They organized this. And I mean, much more than I can possibly think of or remember. I mean, basically half the university kind of switched from their day job, whatever that day job was, straight to COVID research. And so the mathematicians were doing modeling, the virologists were working on vaccines, the engineers were making ventilators and tests. Basically, everyone that didn't want to be sitting at home or had the ambition to do something exciting got into one of these teams and started working on different parts of the pandemic. So it was a very exciting time to be here. And I think, you know, the higher education sector in general, and Oxford in particular in the UK, really showed many of their strengths in that, you know, they do have the world leaders in many fundamental research areas. And the pandemic was a time where it was not necessarily businesses who were going to being the ones entirely responsible for success. It was going to be people who could build a new technology in a month and have it out there. And in many respects, universities are probably the best of that. And I think, you know, the pandemic showed that. You can compare, you know, the Oxford work to any other company in the world, and I think you would argue that they had much more impact across, I mean, so many different areas. Although, of course, it was a massive university, so it's difficult really to compare these things.
Can I ask you, Harrison, you were born in South Australia. You spent some of your formative years in regional New South Wales in Coonabarabran. You moved back to South Australia for your schooling and also went to school in Canberra and went to university in Sydney. And now you're living and working in the UK. My question is, do you have any plans at some point to return to Australia?
Yeah, I think I'll always call Australia home. It's a fantastic place to grow up. At the moment, you know, I'm here in the UK, I guess, in this early part of my career where I'm and building a research team and building new technologies. And these are things that I hope Australia would appreciate and benefit from in the future. And, you know, I'm increasingly trying to get back in and engage with Australian academic research and working with a few different startups there. I'd like one day to be back in Australia at some point, but of course, it's difficult to say, you know, what the future holds in terms of a career, family, and so on. I mean, it's a fantastic country, a great place to live. Every time I go back, maybe don't say this to my UK friends, but you just walk into a restaurant or a supermarket, and it's amazing. Like, everything is just so all the food so good. Everything in the UK, you know, you're eating all this stuff every day, which has been frozen and shipped from across the world because the climate's not appropriate, so growing most of it. And just like the quality of life in Australia is fantastic. You don't have 200 days of overcast weather every year. So in many respects, you do miss these things when you come overseas, and of course, depending where you are. And I do look forward to going back to Australia every year or so and experiencing again, seeing my family, and seeing old friends and so on.
Harrison Steele, Associate Professor at Oxford University and John Monash Scholar, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for coming onto the podcast, and we wish you well in the years ahead.
Thank you very much, Justin. Thanks for having me.